You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Because China is home to the world's largest population with an average of over 10% GDP growth in the past 10 years, it's become a major focus of attention. But according to Tom Doctoroff, the Western media have overlooked many of the most important nuances of the story that they've been covering. In his new book, What Chinese Want, Culture, Communism, and China's Modern Consumer, Mr. Doctoroff pins down the Chinese worldview, secret tensions, values, and consumer desires to help Westerners better understand this major world power. It's published by Paul Gregg Macmillan, and I'm very pleased that it brings Tom Doctoroff to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
You're the Northeast Area Director and Greater China CEO for J. Walter Thompson. Does that give you a better perspective on the subject than even a sophisticated journalist might have?
Well, that's a loaded question if I ever heard one. But I would say that...
Why not start off with the loaded question?
I would say that on our better days, advertising should exist at the intersection of commerce and culture. And one of the things that's interesting about the work that we do is we work in so many different categories, so many different market segments, that we have to analyze how products fit into people's lives and what motivations they address. So after doing a lot of work, you start to see variations on unifying themes emerge. So I don't want to say that advertising people are more insightful about the Chinese than journalists, but I think we do take it from a different angle.
Well, you're doing a lot more research.
Yes.
On what people want and what they say they want, what they actually buy.
Absolutely.
And all the variations.
Yeah, in order to turn a mouse into Mickey Mouse, you need to charge a price premium, and you need to do the research to know what people are willing to pay money for.
So what are the biggest misconceptions Westerners have about the Chinese? And how are they formed, do you think?
Well, I think the biggest misperception, even though this, you could call it a theoretical abstraction, is that as China modernizes and as China becomes more international, it's becoming more Western. And what I mean by that is people assume here in the West that China is becoming more individualistic. That's not true. But looks can be deceiving. When you go to China, you see a lot of impulses of self-expression. You see a lot of fashion. You see huge egos and a demand to be acknowledged for your contribution to society. But the reality still remains true, and that is that in China, a Confucian society, the individual is never existing independent of his obligations and responsibilities to other people. The basic productive unit of China remains the clan.
In Russia, after the fall of communism, suddenly with the newfound wealth of some people, bling became the big thing. Is bling big in China as well?
Understated bling is important. Actually, there's a unifying conflict of Chinese people, and that is that people want to stand out, but at the same time they want to fit in. People are ambitious, but at the same time they can't rebel against the system. So what people want to do is be acknowledged, but they don't want to be too obvious in asking for that acknowledgement. So bling bling does not work. It's too off-putting. But the Mont Blanc six-point star is conspicuously understated.
Well, you repeatedly emphasize a conflict in contemporary Chinese society between ambition and regimentation. So is this something that people are even aware of in themselves?
You know, that's a very interesting question. I don't think so. I think that the Chinese are aware of their the hierarchical restrictions, but this conflict that people have in their heart. When I have conversations with people and we slowly uncover it, and then I reveal this is a thesis or a theory, people seem like this is a new insight. But then they say, yes, this is true. And sometimes people will say, oh, you advertising people understand the Chinese even better than the Chinese understand themselves.
So how does this come into play? Is it a conflict reflected in the government or in the general Chinese public?
It exists everywhere, on government level and also in consumer behavior. Like, for example, and I know this is somewhat off topic, but, you know, the recent Bo Xilai episode, many people think that he was taken down because it represents some fundamental power structure within the Communist Party between the reformists and the statists. That's not true. That tension has existed and will continue to exist for a long time, just as Republicans and Democrats will lock horns. But what he did is he stood out too much. There is a expression in China, in Chinese, that says the leading goose gets shot down. People want to be in front, but it's too dangerous to be in front. So that's what happened with Bo Xilai.
Well, the way it was presented in the Western media was that he presented himself as a neo-Maoist, and at the same time, he actually was living a very different kind of life, and a very ostentatious life, but that it also had to do with the power struggle between the people who would like to return to some form of Maoism and the people who want to move into another direction.
Well, I think that the consensus of pragmatic reform is pretty broad-based, and then a lot of what the debate is about is what the pace should be and what you can do to avoid upsetting the apple cart. I personally believe that Bo Xilai fell because he was a narcissist, not a Maoist, that he was megalomaniacal, and that whipped up fear of cultural revolution hysteria, which again is non-stabilizing.
It was confusing to a lot of Westerners is why many of the people who were allied with him have paid the price, but not everyone.
And I can't answer that. I don't know how they pick their sheep.
But anyhow. We have to deal with people in power, the government in Beijing, the same way we used to have to deal with the Kremlin, where you look at where people are placed when a photograph is taken to understand just who's closest to the real power.
There are leadership minuets. There's no question about that. But in general, the Chinese are very pragmatic. And as soon as we can express things in terms of efficiency and reinforcing stability, which is the platform of economic progress, they can become very, very direct.
A lot of us may think that we know about China because of the news articles we read every day. But there are many, many misconceptions, which is what Tom Doktoroff is addressing in his new book called What Chinese Want. One of the myths that you write about is that the Chinese growth model is in critical danger, but hasn't it slowed down a lot?
It has slowed down. And again, I have to caveat this to the 10th degree. I am not an economist. But to me, you know, the slowdown is almost part of the growth model in terms of the a little bit of the rebalancing between investment and domestic consumption. But what I mean by the growth model is urbanization. Urbanization has been the underlying plank that has lifted people from low productivity jobs to higher productivity jobs. And I think that as soon as people move into the city, now this is not a simple process, okay, but as soon as people move into the city, then consumer behavior is liberated and wealth is generated to provide the degrees of freedom for some of the inefficient capital allocations that exist in China.
In his latest book about China, James Fallows wrote about whether or not China is a low-wage trap.
I don't think so, because I believe that Chinese are good at incremental innovation, not mold-breaking innovation. So the question is not just low raise, but it's an overall price-value equation. Are the goods being produced in China, when you take the cost and the benefits of them, are they superior to its neighbors? And then when you also think about the fact that China is urbanizing, not by sending people into Shanghai or Beijing, but they are building cities and towns in the countryside. So there are waves and waves, okay, of farmers, okay, that are getting off the farm and increasingly having to travel less distance, you know, to become more productive employees.
In the past, they had to travel across the country to the Pacific coastline,
right,
where the big cities were. Even the new big cities, the fishing villages that suddenly have 10 million populations. Getting back to that whole thing about how much you can figure out by who's placed where, the Chinese government regularly replaces leaders. So will we have a better sense of where China is going to be going in the future, in the next five-year plan, because they keep on doing these five-year plans, when the leadership changes later this year?
Well, I certainly don't want to say that the Chinese government is transparent, and you do have to read tea leaves to a certain extent. But the betting is that the fifth generation of leadership, okay, Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang, are more broad-minded and more instinctively reformist and less protective. So I think a lot of people are expecting that there will be more gradual political reform than under Hu Jintao, who had never any experience really leading a modern economic province.
But we do see constant crackdowns on anything might even appear to be slightly dissident, including, you know, artists like Ai Weiwei, not just people who are actually calling for more democratization.
Absolutely. Don't get me wrong. See, this is where the consensus comes in. Nobody is going to brook alternative power centers. And that is, by the way, the phrase that the censors use to make sure that we don't have crowds in our advertising. But
you can't show a crowd?
No, you can't show a crowd when it comes to, and he's looking up at another person that is not a government official. So I remember one time, way off topic here, but we did a Pizza Hut ad in 1999 or 2000, and this was when they were introducing the Edge Pizza. So we showed a boy getting on a desk, okay, and doing a sell for the pizza, describing it in mouthwatering terms, and then students started to gather. It was banned instantly. And the phrase that the censors used was alternative center of power. And it was not just banned in Beijing, but it was banned in Guangzhou, which is supposedly in the south a more liberal province.
So you have to deal with each separate area as though it were a separate community?
Not really. I mean, technically you do, but they take their cues from Beijing.
Now, why do you think...
The Beijing TV.
With that in mind, why do you think Falun Gong has been treated so harshly by the Chinese government? I mean, if they just left it alone, it probably would – it's kind of a cult. It would develop a certain following, and that would be the end of that. There are other religions that have a certain amount of freedom in China.
I think that you're tapping into something that's very important. I do think it's a balance. On one hand, the government does need to control or manage the contours of the debate. This is expected from a patriarchal government and a country and a people that is at ease with top-down management. China, when it talks about democracy, there's a but coming, all right? China, when they talk about democracy, they're not talking about representative democracy in a Jeffersonian sense of the people, by the people, for the people. When Chinese say democracy, they're talking about responsive government, government that is efficient, increasingly transparent, and able to address the economic interests of an increasingly diverse and dynamic population. As part of that whole covenant between people and rulers, people do expect the government to define the terms of the debate, as long as it's done with transparency and efficiency. Now, I also believe that you're right. I believe that the government is too sensitive, right, to any form of questioning or aggregated, I don't want to call it dissent, but aggregated questioning. And I'm hoping that once the government really realizes that the Chinese, down to the lower levels of society, have emerged as a nation of realists, that they can afford a more mature debate.
Well, how much of this is also just a consciousness of Chinese history? Because there were any number of rebellions that were fired by religious groups. A crazed Christian group in the 19th century rebelled, and millions of lives were lost.
Well, there is always a paranoia on the part of the Chinese government that any type of emotional hysteria can spin quickly out of control. The reason why the government doesn't like religion is it's non-technocratic, it's non-rationalistic, it's faith. And what the Chinese Communist Party is a legion of technocratic engineers. So it's not just a question of competitive power. It's also a question of an emotionalism that they don't know how to manage.
So when we hear that the Chinese people have no beliefs, they obviously do have beliefs. They're Confucianists.
Yes.
And if there wasn't such a big crackdown on other religions, perhaps we would see more expression of Christian belief or Taoism or Buddhism or...
Well, Christianity is never going to sell big, even though it's growing. But the relationship between the Chinese and Jesus Christ is very different from the relationship that Westerners have with Jesus Christ. Because in China, there's no moral absolutism. You know, the quid pro quo of if you accept Jesus Christ or God into your heart and you accept his morality as absolute, you will be rewarded with eternal life in heaven. That does not land, all right? So I think that the Chinese Jesus is the Chinese Buddha. But to address your question, yes, I do think that Chinese have beliefs. I do think that Chinese have belief in the sanctity of the family. I do think that Chinese believe that the individual identity cannot be separated from his affiliation with family and nation. I do think that Chinese believe that the family is more important than the individual. And I do think that Chinese believe in meritocracy. I think what's happened in the past few years, you know, ever since Deng Xiaoping in 1992 mandated a new definition of success as material wealth and the ability to generate capital on behalf of a great and glorious motherland, is material expression has spun out of control. And that is being rebalanced a little bit right now.
It is.
But it's a rediscovery of Chinese worldview, not a spiritual disorientation.
It is ironic that the Maoists would rail against materialism, and now materialism seems to be at the center of the new Chinese communism. My guest is Tom Doctoroff, Doctoroff. He lives in Shanghai. He's written a book called What Chinese Want, Culture, Communism, and China's Modern Consumer. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Tom Doctoroff, who is with J. Walter Thompson, does advertising in China, and that's given him insights into, the title of his book is What Chinese Want, Culture, Communism, and China's Modern Consumer. His book is published by Palgrave Macmillan. You say that young Chinese people are intoxicated by American TV series like Gossip Girl and The Big Bang Theory and Hollywood movies and NBA players. Now, what happens when Gossip Girls has a crowd scene and somebody jumps up on a desk? Do they censor it?
No, they don't censor it. Well, a lot of it is illegal DVDs, number one. All right. So Gossip Girl, I actually think, has got streaming rights on Sohu.com, which is one of the major portals. But the reason why Chinese like Friends, Gossip Girl, The Big Bang Theory, even Desperate Housewives and Lost, Prison Break, they all have something in common. And that's that they have individual quirkiness within a group context. So the group supports the individual idiosyncrasies of the characters. And that's a very reassuring facet.
So they see it through a Chinese filter.
They definitely do. See, there is a unifying tension in China between ambition and regimentation, between standing out and fitting in, between projecting status and protecting yourself. So in China, egos are huge. People want to be acknowledged for who they are. And this is very important, by the way, in consumer behavior. But they don't want to stand out and be isolated. You know, I always call Western individualism like Eve's apple. You know, it's tempting, it's succulent, but if you bite into it, you get banished to the land of outcasts.
Well, how different is it from the way the Japanese have dealt with these two issues?
It's very different.
Because in the Japanese cliche is if a nail stands up, you hammer it down.
And again, I think that cliche is very instructive. The Japanese, when they say harmony, they mean consensus, fitting in, and primary satisfaction taken from the fact that there is harmony between people. the Chinese, and it's like, I always say it's like eating Häagen-Dazs ice cream. It just feels real good. You know, it's an internal benefit. The Chinese, when they talk about harmony, and they use the same word, the same characters, it means order and stability. It's a tool. Everything in China is a tool, a means to an end. There are very few internalized benefits.
But I noticed that, as in Japan, Christmas has become a popular holiday now. This is despite the fact that it has no relation to any Chinese religious belief.
Yeah, Christmas, I think,
it's just a time to give gifts.
It's an opportunity to have some fun, but also, you know, between boyfriends and girlfriends, men in China have a difficult time because they always have to prove their worth. They have to prove and demonstrate their commitment. So gift giving in China is a mark of future reliability, not just romantic attachment.
Well, you mentioned boyfriends and girlfriends. One of my staff members grew up in China, and she says in high school they would actually go out with flashlights and check out, make sure that boys and girls weren't getting too close to each other. You weren't expected to even, it was frowned upon if you were dating before you got to college.
It's still the case. I don't know about the flashlight story. I mean, that seems pretty extreme. But on the other hand, who knows? But I think that it's not a moral question. It's a question of pragmatism. The parents are worried that if you're not focused on your studies, right, you won't get into a better university.
But you say also that there's this contradiction there, sex in China, prurience and prudence.
Yeah. Chinese are very pragmatic when it comes to sex.
Is the American, all those things from American entertainment having an impact on that?
I don't think so. I think that if you go back in time and you see the old movies or you read, you know, history, there's always been, because there's always been a way of, a variety of ways to release your urges. I hope that's not too explicit phraseology. But marriage in China, and diamond rings are positioned differently in China than they are in the West, is not about a union between two individuals. When we say a diamond is forever in America, we mean love, romantic passion that lasts a lifetime. When we say a diamond is forever in China, we mean commitment that lasts a lifetime. Because marriage is between two individuals, yes, but also two families coming together in China. And marriage is essentially a protective bulwark against the vicissitudes of life. So in general, and I'm making a sweeping generalization here, Chinese women get very frightened when any influence can affect the stability of the marriage. So they'll be much willing to turn a blind eye to an hour at a massage parlor than they will a mistress.
You talk about the Chinese dream. Now, we've talked about the American dream, which seems to be fading.
Mm-hmm.
What is the Chinese dream?
Well, is the Chinese American dream fading? Well, that we'll discuss later. All right.
But, polls indicate that that fewer people believe that they actually can rise forget about poverty, but, you know, from
the lower
middle class and actually become president of the United States.
Okay.
or become a billionaire.
I still am not pessimistic about the future of America, but I think that the American dream and the Chinese dream have superficial similarities. They're both about money and that culminate in freedom. But again, in America, freedom is an end in itself. It's just something that is good. In China, freedom is a means to an end. It's about control of destiny. It's about having enough money so that you can manage your fate. Chinese dream of control. Actually, whenever you talk about the Chinese dream, it's always vertical. You know, people are thinking themselves up in the air, looking down, in command of everything below.
My guest is Tom Doctoroff. His book, What Chinese Want, Culture, Communism, and China's Modern Consumer, published by Palgrave Macmillan. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You cite Han Han, a famous Chinese writer and car racer. Last year, he wrote three articles on freedom, democracy, and revolution, and that sparked violent debates in China. What
violent?
Did he say?
Well, actually, I'm surprised about this because I think that Han Han, if you really write what he's saying, he's not a rebellious force. I think a lot
of people felt that he was actually being a mouthpiece for the government.
Though they thought that last night, that he was being a mouthpiece for the government. I mean, he is not truly rebellious. I didn't know that people were thinking he was a mouthpiece for the government. So I'm not aware of exactly the content of the articles that you're talking about. But he is somebody that is Chinese, actually, in the sense that he does not want to see American individualism in China because he doesn't think it fits.
Now, let's talk about one of the other aspects. You're in advertising. You're selling American brands.
Yes.
We've been hearing recently about the Chinese being suspicious of some of their own products because of all those adulteration scandals and the like, lead paint and toys.
Yes.
Most recently, an electric car that became a fireball after it was hit by another car. And now that car company is suffering as a result. People just don't seem to trust Chinese products. But are they still buying mostly Chinese products?
They are, because Chinese products boast two strengths that it's difficult for Western products to have. One is low, low price, and the other is broad scale and distribution breadth and heft. There's a great white space, for the most part, between international products which are capable of commanding a price premium but have relatively narrow market shares, and Chinese products which are accessible price-wise.
But you also suggest that if it's something that it will be in the home and nobody will see it, they're more likely to buy a Chinese product. But if it's something...
Definitely.
A car that they're driving around, or, as you point out, a very nice pen,
the foreign one. The golden rule of marketing in China is that in order to charge a price premium, you have to maximize public consumption, and that can be done in a variety of ways. But price premiums are paid for face.
But doesn't Gillette do very well? Those are things in the home.
No, yes, those are things in the home. But actually, the percentage of wet shaving is relatively low. The question is, what's the penetration of Gillette, right? And what percentage of male shavers are actually using Gillette, and what are using Gillette four blades? Very, very small. In fact, you can't even find the four-bladed Fusion in China. They're usually the disposable or a cheaper wet shaving system.
Pizza Hut and Haagen-Dazs are thriving in the Chinese market.
Right, and they're thriving as publicly consumed items. No Chinese is ever going to pay $6 for a half pint of ice cream to go enjoy in front of an illegal DVD.
Does it matter whether you're in one of the first-tiered cities like Beijing and Shanghai or whether you're in one of the lower tier ones?
Well, I think that geography is often a red herring. I think that even in the lower tier cities, a new middle class is emerging in each one of them. So the real variables of marketing in China are age and income. And I think that you'll find a lot of similarities across different tier cities as long as you're targeting more or less the same socioeconomic group. On average, yes, there are differences, but you need to target and segment.
Well, how much is the fact that the Chinese are less likely to buy certain products, foreign-made products, based on price, how much of that is a reason that foreign investors don't want to get into China, and how much of it is just the obstacles to getting into China, especially corruption, which you write about in this book?
I don't think corruption is a huge demotivator. I think that Chinese can be very pragmatic as long as win-win goals are established. Contract abidance, for example, as long as things are made explicit and transparent, the Chinese can be actually quite easy to do business with. But getting to your question, I think that marketers need to adjust their strategies to penetrate and generate both scale and margin in China. And the smartest marketers in China are able to use the brand to extend it out across different product categories. So it's not just a Louis Vuitton handbag, but it's much cheaper but still expensive in terms of price premium, sunglasses, keychains, mobile phone straps, and also do sub-branding and price tiering so that you can still grow the franchise but not have to buy the most expensive unit.
Would something that's made in China but is associated with the West, like the iPhone, would that be popular in China?
Well, the iPhones are incredibly popular, and Chinese are proud that they're produced in China under international management.
After the dissident Cheng Wancheng arrived in the U.S. last week, he wrote an article for the New York Times just a couple of days ago, in which he says China does not lack law, but the rule of law.
Huh. That's a head-scratcher.
Well, he says that, you know, there are all these good laws in place, but then...
Oh, does not have law. Does not lack law, I think
yes.
he said.
But the rule of law doesn't apply.
China is not a civil society, and I need to define that phrase. There are not the institutions that are designed to protect impartially the economic and political interests of the individual. Because, again, the individual is not the basic productive unit of society. So when he says lack of rule of law, what he's saying is it's not yet an institutionally driven society, and that is very true. People know this.
Well, we've talked about a number of contradictions.
Yeah.
Contradictions always cause problems. Do you think that they'll ever resolve them?
Well, first of all, nobody can say anything with certainty, but I'm relatively optimistic. I'm relatively optimistic that China can implement gradual political reform because it's the pragmatic thing to do. It will not be breakthrough, but it will be incremental. However, when China needs to become an innovative society in order to continue its growth trajectory, say when average per capita income is $10,000, $12,000, that's going to be problematic because I don't think that China has the seeds of bottom-up innovation.
Well, what about the fact that China is really so many different people? Okay, there's the Han that dominate much of the society, but then when you go west, you have Tibet, you have the Uyghurs, and they always seem to be real problems for the government.
The Chinese know how to keep things in order. And I think that there is not enough power in these autonomous regions to really have mobilized dissent. And I also think that the Chinese people, and by that I mean the Han Chinese people, they view territorial disintegration as the third rail of paranoia. This is not just top-down fiat, but territorial integrity is at the very center of the heart of desire for Chinese people. The people would never let the government get away with any type of autonomous movement.
So they would, if the government said, okay, we're going to let Tibetans rule themselves. The rest of the people themselves would start complaining.
No, they wouldn't care if Tibetans had more operational autonomy, but I'm talking about independence. I mean, just like Taiwan, for example, everybody in China, again, is pragmatic. Many people will say, well, why doesn't Taiwan become, you know, part of a Commonwealth of China, right? Or a federation? People would support it as long as the status quo is maintained and there is no formal independence declared. But if formal independence was declared, the government would instantly lose its legitimacy.
Tom Doctoroff is the Northeast Asia Area Director and Greater China CEO for J. Walter Thompson, the author of a number of books. The most recent one, the one we've been discussing, is called What Chinese Want, Culture, Communism, and China's Modern Consumer. It's published by Paul Grabe Macmillan. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.